Okay, it is time for us to get started this morning. I do thank you for being here with me this morning. We got a little bit of a late, just a few minutes late here this morning, but I don't think I'll probably hear anybody complain about that. We are in Matthew chapter 5 this morning. If you are watching on Facebook, I know we shared this on different pages, but if you comment on the Bible Media page, then I will actually be able to see it during the broadcast. So if you have a comment or anything like that, if you watch it through the Byway Media page on Facebook, then I'll be able to see that. Of course, you can watch it anywhere, but I may not see your comment on other pages until after this is over. We are picking up this morning Matthew chapter 5 in verse 10. We started last week working our way through what we commonly refer to as the Beatitudes in Matthew chapter 1. Actually, Matthew chapter 5, rather, beginning in verse 1. We talked about the Beatitudes. We talked about back beginning in verse 2, blessed are poor in spirit. We talked about verse 3, blessed are those who mourn. There's going to be verse 4, blessed are those who mourn. Verse 5, blessed are the meek. Verse 6, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Verse 7, blessed are the merciful. Verse 8, blessed are pure in heart. Verse 9, blessed are the peacemakers. And now this morning we're picking up in verse 10. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, just a word about persecution. Good morning, Christy, and yes, good morning, Peggy. Thank you both for being here this morning. Just a word about persecution. We know there are those today who think that persecution is something that, well, that happens when someone doesn't accept your invitation to a Bible class. Or they think, well, persecution is someone who gets upset when I talk to them about the Bible. And no doubt that is disheartening. But persecution in the first century was not like what we think of today. There is no doubt in my mind there are those throughout the world, and yes, even in our country, who are persecuted for setting up for godly morals, setting up for the Bible, setting up for the church. But sometimes, or I think many times, there are those who feel like they're being persecuted, when in reality they're not being persecuted at all. They kind of feel like, well, if anything happens at all, well, I'm being persecuted, and that's really not the case. Not saying we are not persecuted today, but I think we do have some who have a very poor view of persecution. But nonetheless, we find here in verse 10, blessed are those who are persecuted, and he tells us, for righteousness' sake. So there is a condition, there is a somebody to consider, not just being persecuted, but you're persecuted for being righteous. You're persecuted for trying to do for what is doing what is right in the sight of God. He says in verse 10, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. The promise gave them is that it's to encourage them, that those who are persecuted for doing what is right, they can rest in safe knowing that their kingdom is going to be the kingdom of heaven. Their resting place will be with God and with Christ and all the faithful. I do think sometimes when we talk about persecution, there are those who want to stir up things so they can say they're being persecuted. I've seen a lot of Facebook groups that seem to thrive on no doubt teaching the truth, but I think sometimes they go too far in the sense that, what I mean by that is they take delight in getting people upset. They take delight in making people angry. That is not what we find in the Bible. You know, if people got upset with what Christ said, you know, he dealt with it. But his point was not to upset people. His point was to teach the truth. So it was with Paul and with Peter and all the other apostles as well. Their point was not to deliberately upset people. But their point was to teach the truth. And if it upset people, so be it. But there are those today who thrive on upsetting people. They say things to deliberately get a rise and to cause up a stir. There are those who, instead of teaching the truth, as one brother put it, they like to go out into the weeds and try to stir up things. Oftentimes, they really don't know what they're talking about. But we find here in verse 10, these individuals who are persecuted because they're trying to do what is right and what is good and what is pleasing to God. And so what he's telling us here in verse 10 are those who are persecuted for doing what is right, for following God and his word. He says their kingdom, theirs is the kingdom of heaven, meaning when this life is over, they're going to be going to heaven, because when they're persecuted, it's not because they're doing evil. It's not because they're doing some type of sin. It's because they're trying to do what is right. And people sometimes respond in a way which we wish was different. In verse 11, he says, blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Now, here again, here's the condition. Against you falsely. I mean, if they speak against you, make sure it's false. Make sure it's not right. He says, when they speak evil against you falsely, and he says, for my sake. So there's two things there. When they speak evil against you falsely, and when they do so for his sake, trying to attack Christ. You know, when a Christian is attacked, when a faithful Christian is attacked, Christ is attacked. I think that's the idea we find here in verse 11 as well. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you. Now, again, I think this is where people sometimes have taken this section of verse 11 saying, see, I got all these people upset, but, you know, I'm blessed because of that. Because, you know, people get upset. Well, that's okay. I'm blessed because they're upset about what I'm saying. That's not our goal in life. If our whole goal in life is to sit down and make all these little videos that are going to make people upset, friends, we are wasting our time. And if we're honest, you're going to scare a lot more people away than you are going to attract them. We hear sometimes, you know, it's easier you catch more flies with honey than you do with vinegar. What I mean by that, I don't mean that we don't teach the truth, because we have to teach the truth. But some people forget the whole part about teaching the truth in love. They think it's truth in love when they just browbeat you, or when they mock you. You can't speak the truth in love and do so in a mocking tone. And so when you look here in verse 11, when they revile and persecute you, and you say all kinds of evil against you falsely. I mean, when they say things against you, let it be false. Let there be no truth to it. And let them do so on the account of Christ. I mean, let them speak against you, make up all this stuff because you're trying to do what is right. Verse 12, he says, Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. So when you are persecuted, when you are mocked, when you are attacked for trying to do what is right and good and pleasing in the sight of God, he said, you should be rejoicing and be exceedingly glad. Again, our goal in life is not to raise people's blood pressure and get them all upset with us. Our goal in life is to teach the truth and warn people. And if they get upset, sometimes that just happens, doesn't it? He says, for great is your reward in heaven, not on earth, but in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. So it reminds us that there are others who have gone before you who have endured persecution. Those, for honesty, gone before us have endured a whole lot more than just someone rolling their eyes at us. And we think someone rolling their eyes at us or making some snide comment or laughing in our face, we think that's bad. Wait till you go back and look at how some of the apostles were treated. Go back and look at the Apostle Paul, who, after his conversion, he began teaching and preaching. What happened? They had to put him in a basket and lower him down outside the wall because the Jews already wanted to kill him. They didn't want to mock him. They wanted to kill him. They wanted him dead. That is true hardcore persecution. And even that did not stop Saul, who later become who we know later as Paul. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Now in verse 13 through 16, again, there's so many sections in the Sermon on the Mount which are so well known, but yet so many people today still misapply it, especially when it comes to their own lives. We look at verse 13. He says, you are the salt of the earth. Now who's he talking to? He's talking to followers of Christ. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? Now, if you ever opened up salt and it's been there too long, maybe there's some water got into it or something, and it's clumped up, it's not good anymore. He says, if it loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? He said, it is then good for nothing to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. And so, if you imagine going to grab the salt shaker, you know, many restaurants, or some I should say, not many, will have grains of rice in the salt, and the purpose is to pull the moisture out away from the salt and go to the rice instead, and the salt will remain good. It's to keep it, you know, usable. Well, here the idea of the salt losing its flavor, of course, salt is not, this is not literal things, these are figurative, and the salt loses its flavor. Well, he tells us in verse 13 that you are the salt, so the Christian is the salt. Well, how does a Christian lose its flavor? And when a Christian loses their faith, they lose their flavor. He says, and how shall it be seasoned? So you're the salt of the earth. So you're the one seasoning the earth. The salt is the Christian. The flavor is the faith. So if a Christian loses their faith, how can they season? How can they reach the earth? How can they reach mankind? They can't. An unfaithful Christian cannot reach the lost for Christ. Who's going to listen to an unfaithful Christian, especially if they know they're unfaithful? Who's going to listen to that person, tell them how to get to heaven? Who's going to go listen to someone who hasn't been to a congregation in over a year, and you're going to listen to them tell you how to go to heaven? I don't think so. You going to listen to that same person who's been divorced 6 times tell you how to have a good marriage? I don't think so. You going to listen to drunk tell you how to have a good home life? I don't think so. You going to listen to one who's been arrested for abusing his children and tell you how to raise your child? I don't think so. The unfaithful cannot reach the lost. If the salt loses its flavor, if the Christian loses her faith, how can they reach the lost? They can't. He tells us there in verse 13, is then good for nothing. What is good for nothing? The salt. The Christian who loses their faith, he says, they're worth nothing when it comes to trying to reach the lost, right? It says, then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. The unfaithful Christian has done what? Gone back into the world. Look at verse 14. You, that is who again? The Christian. Now he goes from verse 13, he uses the salt. Now in verse 14, he talks about light. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Now, if you've ever been driving at night, I'm sure you have, and you come down a straightaway. I remember one area in Arkansas where I used to live. When you came through a certain area, you could see the lights of the city coming up over the hills. And it would just be like a little white glow coming over the hill. Before you topped the hill near, you'd see most of the city. That's what I think of here in verse 14. Can you hide a city that has lights like that? No, you can't hide it. Everybody's going to see it. Anybody nearby is going to see it. Even far away, you can still see the light coming up over the hill. So it affects a lot of people, right? So he says, you are the light of the world, the Christian. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. So a Christian who is set up on the position to reach those around them, they cannot be hidden. Siri's trying to butt in our Bible study. So a city that is set up on a hill cannot be hidden. So same way as a Christian who is set up where they can reach the world, they're letting the light shine, they can reach a whole lot of people. But if their light goes out, what's going to happen? Well, they can't reach anybody. Verse 15 says, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. So you don't hide the light. You know, when you go and turn on a lamp or light a candle, do you put something on top of it to hide it? No, that makes no sense. Why would you do that? And that's the same idea here with the Christian, right? The Christians lie to the world. Why don't we put a basket over ourselves or veil ourselves in the world so they cannot see our light? There's no sense in doing that. And so we look here in verse 18. Verse 15. You cannot hide yourself from the world. We cannot be those who hide our light. You go back here, look now at verse 16, he says, let your light so shine before men. I mean, let your light shine in such a way that others around you can see it. Others can see your faith in Christ. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. Now, there's a word about these good works. There's a lot of people today who will go out and do a lot of good things, helping the needy, helping those who are hungry, clothing people, all types of things. And they think, well, if I do those things, I'm a Christian, everybody's going to see it, and that's the kind of stuff I do, and I'll do all that, and that's all I'm going to do. You know, there's a lot of denominations today, especially, but there are also churches of Christ who have put so much emphasis on works, on good deeds, and on these outreach efforts, as they call it, to help and help clothe people, help feed people, all this stuff, that they do all that, and they lost the focus of, okay, are we actually reaching anyone with the gospel, or are we only feeding people? Are we only clothing people? Are we only, counseling people through addiction or whatever it may be? Because we find here in verse 16, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works. Well, your good works are one thing, but your light needs to shine through your good works, not just your good works. And so, you know, these outreach programs need to be actually outreach programs, not just feeding people, not just clothing people, but actually trying to reach people with the gospel. Because if all it is trying to clothe people and nothing else, then you're not letting your light shine before men. I know one group around here, when they have a food giveaway, that cars will pull up, they'll put food bags of food in people's cars, and they drive on, and that's it. That may be good work because you get to help people who are in need. Now, in their case, I'm glad they're not teaching them anything. But if that's the Church of Christ who does that, I'm thinking, well, you're missing a golden opportunity. Why not use that chance to talk to people, to at least invite people? Instead, it's, here you go, on your way, here you go, on your way. That's not what Christ is talking about here in verse 16. You cannot glorify your Father in heaven, as he says in verse 16, if your good works are just good works. You've got to let your light shine before men while you're doing those types of good works, while you're doing any good work. And that good work can be as well just trying to reach people with the gospel, trying to invite people, those types of things. In verse 17, he says, do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. So he tells us there in verse 17, he didn't come to destroy the old law. He came so that he could fulfill it. The old law talked all about Christ and him coming. Even going back to Moses in the book of Deuteronomy, he talks about how there is one coming after him. In verse 17, he says, do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. He didn't come to destroy them or do away with them. He came to fulfill them. Now, if something is fulfilled, it means they have served their purpose, right? So he came to do what? To fulfill the law and what was said in the prophets concerning him. He came to what? Show that those things have been fulfilled and that the law and what the prophets have said have served their purpose. Verse 18, for surely I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. So what he's saying is the earth will not be destroyed. The earth and the end will not come until all things in the old law have been fulfilled. Not one thing will pass away until the old law has been fulfilled. Has the old law been fulfilled? Yes. Christ has fulfilled the old law. We're no longer under the old law. In verse 19, whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments, because during Christ's time, when he was on the earth, until Christ died on the cross and rose again, until those things happened, they were under the old law. And so for that reason, that's why he tells them in verse 19, other places as well, to keep the old law until what? Until it was fulfilled. Here therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so, shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. So what is he telling people? The old law hasn't been fulfilled yet. He came to fulfill it. And until that happens, verse 19, what? Keep the commandments. Follow the commandments. If someone teaches you to do otherwise, what? Don't listen to them. You keep the old law until the old law has been fulfilled. Verse 20 is a very big verse. I think sometimes people misunderstand this. They think, okay, I got to be really, really righteous. What? And we want to be righteous people. We have to understand the Pharisees and scribes were not righteous, not even close to being righteous. Instead, what we find numerous times, especially in the gospel accounts, is that these individuals were the biggest hypocrites the world probably has ever seen. We find in verse 20, it says, for I say to you, unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. Well, they were what? They were hypocrites. They were liars. They were deceivers. They were haughty. They were We go look in Matthew chapter 6, we'll see how he talks about those hypocrites who do certain things. He tells us repeatedly, don't be like them, as we get to Matthew chapter 6 later. Instead, he tells us here in verse 22, let our righteousness exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees. What he's telling us is, you be better than them, because they're not righteous at all. They are selfish, they are greedy, they are all those numerous ways, things we see displayed or on display by their cold and calloused heart. And you see that as you go throughout the scriptures. You find numerous occasions where the Pharisees and scribes and others try to trap Christ. They try to say they cast out demons by the power of Beelzebub, which is the most ridiculous statement probably you find in the Bible or close to it. And we'll get to that later as well. So he tells us is, unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, unless you're more righteous than them, unless you're better than these guys, you'll by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. It means you can't be like these guys who are hypocrites and liars and backbiters and deceivers and dishonest and false teachers and on the list goes. Be better than them. Verse 21, he says, you have heard that was said to those of old, you shall not murder, neither murders will be danger of judgment. But I say to you, whoever is angry with his brother without a cause should be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says that his brother Raka should be in danger of the council, but whoever says you fool should be in danger of hell fire. Now what we find here is we find several occasions in the Bible where Christ talks about the old law and then he, what I call, raises the bar. It means, you know, in the old law it was don't commit adultery. And Christ, as we find here, says don't even look on a woman to lust after her. because that's how it starts. And so he doesn't just say don't commit adultery. He says don't even look on a woman to lust after them. Because what we find is, as he's going to tell us, is that's how it begins. And as we find here, murder, what is he saying? He says what? Murder begins in the heart. It means don't talk, but don't be angry with your brother without a cause. Don't call people names. Don't be angry with people. Don't speak against them, because that's how things escalate, right? You look in verse 22. He says an interesting thing here. He says, and whosoever says to his brother Raca shall be in danger of the council. Now, Raca here, let me find a place, is believed to be an Aramaic word meaning empty. So compare empty-headed or stupid or numbskull. Such contempt and unrighteous anger of speech may get by earthly judges, but such insults and angry sayings will not escape the counsel of God. And then he talks about here in verse, he goes on to say here in verse 22, but whoever says you fool shall be in danger of hell fire. Fool is stupid and expresses contempt from one's heart and character. So such statements of unrighteous anger and a lack of respect puts one in position of giving an awful account in the day of judgment. Hellfire is the Gehenna of fire. And this is an awful price to pay for letting our anger and emotions run away. And as he's saying, there's okay to say Raca, but not okay to say you fool. No. What he's talking about here is how things escalate. First, it's you're angry without a cause. And then you say, says his brother Raca, meaning you empty-headed. And then he says you fool. And what happens? It just escalates. Don't let things escalate. And we continue to talk about here in verse 23. He says, therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. What he's saying is, before you come and you offer your gift or your sacrifice, your offering, because they were under the old law, he says, you remember you have something against your brother, go take care of that first. That's what he's talking about. Go take care of that first. Don't let that hinder your offering, right? Again, the Old Testament laws was what they're under here. Then he says in verse 25, agree with your adversary quickly while you're on the way with him, lest your adversary deliver you to the judge hand you over to the officer, and you be thrown to prison. Surely I say to you, you by no means get out of there till you have paid the last penny. Verse 25 and 26, what he's saying, take care of your adversaries. Take, you have someone who has something against you, and he says, while you're with him on the way, he says, agree with your adversary quickly. Well, you think about this. Is there ever anything good that comes out of a Christian appearing in a courtroom? Not one time. I don't care what it's about. Anytime a Christian has been in a courtroom, it's never a good thing. And so what he's trying to tell us here in verse 25 and 26 is don't allow yourself to get in that position. It's like saying you're in a car accident, and well, the person's going to take you to court. You know what? Go and talk with him and figure something out, and don't even go to court. Don't let it get that far. Take care of it. Don't do anything that can allow the Christian name and the church to be blasphemed for any reason. But he tells us here in verse 25, if you don't, what's going to happen? He says, lest your adversary deliver you to the judge hand you over to the officer, and you'll be thrown into prison. Surely I say to you, by no means gather till you have paid the last penny. So he's saying, figure it out. Don't let things escalate, and keep the Christian name and the church from being blasphemed. Keep God from being blasphemed. Now, in verse 27 through verse 30, you have many sections in the Bible and translations have this heading, adultery in the heart. And there are those today who will tell you that if you look upon another and lust after them, you have committed adultery, and they say, well, now that's a cause for divorce. That's not what he's talking about here. Because if you look at Matthew chapter 9, chapter 19, verse 9, the word is fornication, which includes the act of a physical sexual interaction with someone who is not your spouse. What he's talking about here is not physical. Does that mean you can do it? No. But it is not a cause for divorce. There are those who say, well, it is a cause. That's how where it starts. No, it's not. It is not a cause. Is that where it starts? Yes. But it is not a physical act. If that's the case, how many people today are qualified for a divorce? A lot of people, if we're honest. Now, if we look in verse 27 through 30, what is he talking about? He's telling us, don't even let it start. You look upon another person. Now, he talks about here a woman, but we understand, if we're logical people, that it goes both ways, right? A woman looking upon a man looking upon a woman. He's saying, stop it before it goes any further. Change your heart, change your mind. We go to Matthew chapter 19, and verse 9, what does he tell us? Fornication, the physical act of having relations with someone who's not your spouse, that's the only cause for divorce. Now, looking at verse 27, you have heard of a said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you, now this is what I was talking about before. This is where Christ, the old law, you have heard of a said, and now he's saying, this is what I'm telling you now. He's raising the bar. You know, it's not just adultery that's the problem, but don't even let it start. Don't even let it get to that. He says, but I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. There is a big difference today, and we have to be careful with this, but there's a big difference between only seeing someone who is attractive, and then also, but and the difference between that and lusting after a person. It's sad today that you have to be careful with compliments because people misunderstand them. You tell a young man, tells a young lady she looks nice today, or she looks very pretty. I think probably in the church most of the time, 95% of the time, I'm going to estimate, it's probably pure and innocent. But because you have some people today who is always pure and innocent, you have a lot of people today who won't even say those types of things because it is misunderstood, right? It's sad that that's how it is in many places, in many situations. But we find here in verse 29, to lust after a woman is what is sinful. To notice someone of the opposite sex who is attractive is not sinful. Do you remember in the Old Testament when Rachel was first described, who was, quote, as the Bible says, who had soft eyes, and she was beautiful in form and appearance. Form and appearance. What does that mean? I mean, she was a beautiful person, right? Form and appearance. That's biblical. Now, was that lusting? No. But what is that? What was happening there? It was a noticing an attraction, an attractive individual. That's all it was. And what we find here in verse 27 and 28 is something totally different. He says, "But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her, right, there's a sin, has already committed adultery with her in his heart, not physically, but in his heart. Is it wrong? Yes. Is it a divorceable offense? No. Verse 29, if your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. For it's more probable that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. Verse 29. What is he saying? If there's something that causes you to sin or tempts you to sin, remove it. Remove it. How many times have some of us been in the gym and we have to look down the floor and we walk by someone of the opposite sex because of what they're wearing? Well, let's be honest. It's not just the gym, is it? You go into a Walmart. I mean, people say, I can't go to the gym because of this. Okay, that's fine. But can you go to Walmart? Because there's the same type of thing there. Can you go to the store? Can you go out to your neighborhood and watch those who run by, you know, exercising? Same problems are everywhere. So we have to be careful when we try to bind it in one situation because it's everywhere. But we find in verse 29, what's he saying? If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. If there is something that causes you to sin, get yourself out of that situation. If you have had trouble with alcohol in the past and your drive home has liquor store after liquor store after liquor store, what do? You find a different way to go home. If you have problems with lust and the route you take, you see all these different gentlemen's clubs, where there are no gentlemen, by the way. What do? You find a different way to go home. Verse 30, if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. Whether it's your eye or something that you do with your hand, you know, whether it be alcohol or some, whatever it may be, and those are just examples. He says, cut it off and cast it from you. Remove what causes you to stumble from your path, or get yourself a different path, right? He says, for it's more probable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. It's better for you to find a different way home, to look another way, to stare at the ground, do whatever it is, and then to allow yourself to lust, allow yourself to sin, allow things to escalate, and put yourself in a situation that's going to cause you to be in sin and cause a whole list of other problems as well. Okay, we're going to stop there this morning. Next week, Lord willing, when we come back, we'll pick up in Matthew chapter 5 in verse 31. If you have any comments or questions, feel free to put them there in the comment box, or you can message us here on Byway Media through Facebook. Feel free to share this, like it, share it. And the more you share it, the more you like it, the more people get to see it. That's how Facebook works, unless they suppress it, but whatever. Anyway, so feel free to share this far and wide, and hope you join me again next week when we come back here at about 10 o'clock and continue in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 31. So thank you for being here with me today, and hope to see you again next time.